Do we want to spend a couple of minutes just going through a few exercises? We did this last week.
I mean, I'll leave it up to you. We did this as a means to start to sense ourselves in our body. Now, we could have done it sitting on the cushion. Last week, we lay down on the floor for a while, put our feet up on the back of the chair, and, you know, sort of rested and moved our consciousness around different parts of our body. It's a little not going to work easily tonight, but if any of you want to learn about that who didn't do it before, call me and email me. We'll arrange it. I'll explain how we do it. It's fairly simple, but it's a good way to understand that most of the time we're not in our body. We're everywhere else. So, I mean, I think that's the important thing. If we can do a few things every day, we could try spending a few minutes just locating ourselves, you know, locating ourselves in being in the body, feeling the ground we're standing on, feeling the sense of gravity, feeling our fundamental presence on Earth, making this a conscious connection will be very helpful. It steadies us, it simplifies things, it brings us back to simply being here. Wherever we here is, wherever now is, let's be here and now and work with what we have, right? I mean, that's the principle behind it. It's meant to recognize that so often we're not here. And we get caught up with things that never happen, never will happen, and are presumed to, you know, our hopes, our fears. If we actually decided to spend some time just setting that time aside, I'm going to spend 15 minutes a day working on how much I'm afraid I am of everything that could happen, and write down all the things that bother me about somebody so that I can actually decide that's the time I'm going to use for that and leave the rest of the time of my day open for other possibilities, right? I might be a little more efficient, at least in terms of being present. So, and actually, that's potentially the ultimate efficiency is being present. Okay, we won't go through any more of that then.
Were they online from last week?
I don't think she recorded them. We did them before we started the class. But we can do them next week if that's okay. It's easier when we just maybe we'll start the meditation with that first, and that way everybody sort of is more present to their body. Before we actually sit here and watch our minds going all over the place, we're actually going to get into our body a little bit first and then try it. So, okay. Have people had a chance to read the book at all? For those of us who just briefly haven't been here before, and I introduced it earlier tonight, but we're reading this book, Natural Wakefulness by Galen Ferguson. He's a very interesting person who I know well. And, you know, he's offering a more fundamental approach or a basic approach to how to edge ourselves into meditation without feeling intimidated by it or thinking it's too much or too demanding or I'll never get there or it's too boring. I can't stand that, you know. Discovering the wisdom we were born with, I mean, I think that's fundamental to this whole thing, and we're going to go through that and just reviewing some of the discussion. But in any case, in case anyone hasn't bought but wants to purchase a copy, we have them over there. They're $20. You can either give me a check made out to me or just give me cash, and there's no tax. Or you can buy them online, you can get a, you know, Kindle, whatever you want, it's fine. Whatever's easy for you. Okay, so, first of all, he introduces this with this little statement, Vidyadhara Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, Sakyam Nipam Rinpoche. So the Vidyadhara Chögyam Rinpoche was the first Tibetan teacher who really brought teachings of Dharma into the West. There have been other Dharma teachers, but not Tibetan teachers who really actually spoke in English language, really learned how to gather students and actually help them tame and train their minds. Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche is his son. Trungpa Rinpoche died in 1987. His son took over after that. But I want to make it clear from the outset that we're not trying to discuss this in the context of a particular organization, which we happen to have, called Shambhala. That's not what this is about. This is about just basic Buddhism, Buddhist meditation. Because this is a very effective way of understanding the Dharma and understanding Buddhism and meditation, we're using these texts. But beyond that, there's no real bias. So then the other quote, although we stumble, we still aspire to see your face. So this is out of a particular, something that Trungpa Rinpoche discovered. It's a text, it's a kind of a hidden text that Rinpoche had the capacity to discover, sort of like a mind treasure. And one of the elements that we recite in that's called the Dzogchen of Mahamudra is, although I stumble in the thick black fog of materialism, I still aspire to see your face. So your face is the face of the Buddha mind, which we all have within ourselves. It's our own natural wakefulness. It's complete, total sanity. I mean, this is the simplest way to understand. This is sanity that's beyond any kind of conditions, and it doesn't change. It's just there. It's not affected by up or down, right or left, hot or cold, red, white, blue, green. It's just natural, present, now. Now-ness. And it's always here, and each of us have this. So what we're doing is we're learning how to discover that. We're learning we have it. Every person in this room has it. Every person outside of this room has it. Anyone who has ever walked the face of this earth has it, and anyone who ever will has it. So, we're going to learn about that. And in the introduction, he says, the approach here presented here begins with wakefulness as in our original basic state of being alive. The journey of meditation practice follows as a natural unfolding of this innate awareness and kindness. So now this sanity is very kind. It doesn't have any aggression. It has no agendas. It doesn't try to judge. It's not interested in judging. It's not interested in settling scores, retribution. It's not worried about anything. It's completely neutral. And that's why we can trust it. So when we start hearing judgment about ourselves, that's not awake. That's our mind that is trying to entrap and make a judgment or put us in a court of law to decide whether we've lived up to the standards we think we're supposed to have, whether they're our standard or somebody else's. It really doesn't make any difference on one level because, you know, basically we're fundamentally caught up in our thoughts. And where awareness is beyond our thoughts. It is not confined by, and it is not determined by, our thoughts. It is completely free from any kind of thinking at all. Does this make sense? Okay, good. I mean, if we have any questions, please do not hesitate, but this is why we practice meditation. We really want to understand, we want to learn, we want to connect with this fundamental core essence we have. And we cannot really help others too much without really being able to know ourselves, know our own mind, and actually begin to discover how we can understand the essence of others as well. And learn how to address others on that level as we address ourselves, right? So, Did anyone have any fundamental impressions about reading these first three chapters? Was there anything that struck you either positively or negatively, or anything you'd like to bring up before we actually look at the individual aspects of this material?
It was down to earth. I like that. I hadn't heard of it before. I thought it might be too esoteric, but it was very easy to read, understand. It wasn't complicated for someone who didn't know a lot about Buddhism or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. It was easy to read.
Good. Good. Yes, Robert.
The emphasis on gentleness he added, that was very welcome. Because I really liked Pema Chodron, but at the end I got confused by all the five of this and the six of that. And everything. And, where are we going? I need a graph. Sort of starting over with really a nice, gentle touch. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, Buddhism loves roadmaps, and because the mind is so complicated. I mean, it's extremely complex. It is extremely just all over the place. If you have a map, you can sort of be, if you find yourself somewhere, maybe you can find somehow, locate what is actually going on here. And so the map is quite extensive, and it goes on and on and on, just like the mind goes on and on endlessly, doesn't it? But, we started with Pema Chodron, it wasn't like, well, of course, we've been studying this for years, so therefore, of course, we understand how this fits in this chapter and how it applies to going from mindfulness to compassion and, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why we're back here. We're going to start with before any categorizations occur. I think that's the important thing.
This feels like it's more foundational.
Exactly. We need the foundations, and then we can approach, we can do all the lattice work, we can go and actually get the building built. We can actually start putting the floors in, the windows, the walls, the doors, and, the plumbing and electricity, so that actually it all starts to make sense. But why we started with Pema Chodron was simply because it evoked such a strong response when we had a service here once in January of this year. And so many people really responded to the notion of being able to work compassionately and engage positively in the world for others, which is absolutely noble and extremely important and nothing but commendatory. Now we have to understand how we get there so we can actually do this effectively. Otherwise, we're just carrying it all around in our head. So this is helping us really understand. When we know ourselves, we can begin to understand others and be able to really truly be open. And of course, it doesn't mean that we don't have never understood anything at all or any of that kind of thing, but it helps us stay focused in terms of what and how we can truly be effective rather than trying to launch major campaigns against windmills and other kinds of things that are maybe sometimes too big to take on and unrealistic and exhausting and draining, here we start with something we can actually fundamentally know for ourselves and work forward with that. Yes?
I'm struck by contentment within yourself. That's where it starts. Being content with yourself, within your soul.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how he would work around with materialism that we are bombarded with, all these images. How is that going to work? How will this play through? Because you want to be contented with yourself. But at the same time, you see all these things, I might like to want that.
Mm-hmm.
And it all begins with yourself.
Right. Well, we're in a body. And if you're in a body, according to Buddhism, you're in the desire realm. I'll just get a little metaphysical for once. I promise if I do more, call me on it. But so according to this system of understanding, is having a body like we do, on this planet means that we are in what's called the desire realm. And the desire realm is basically fundamentally driven by desire, but it's part of the larger system of samsara or misunderstanding or primordial ignorance, which is characterized by passion, aggression, and ignorance. So the desire realm is kind of where we, our battleground is in terms of our working, coping with our wants and needs, because we have to have needs. We have needs in a body, that's just natural. But the question is whether we actually get so overwhelmed by the energy of desire that we fail to ever exercise the capacity to discover this innate freedom we have. There are other realms. These are the realms of samsara. The formless form realm is the next realm, which is invisible to us, but characteristic of what at least traditional religions have called gods. There are at least 17 form realms that are articulated, and they also involve purer states of mind, we could say, which are more abstract. And for instance, if you think about mathematics, where does mathematics come from? It's not involved. Mathematics is not involved with desire, for instance, right? Mathematics kind of derives or comes from a state of clarity that operates on another level. Anyway, that would be the form realm. Then we have the formless realm, which is more what we would call traditionally cosmic. Absolute space, absolute nothingness, things that are either neither this nor that nor the other, complete boundless luminosity, boundless consciousness. All those things, while they sound tremendously big and vast and interesting, are actually still forms of entrapment, according to Buddhism. Because Buddhism, the Buddha mind itself, or the Buddha essence itself, transcends or is beyond all of those things altogether. So if we can visit these places, we can visit all of these places in terms of our mind, and we often may end up doing this in our meditation practice. But, you know, they are fundamentally only forms of distraction or illusion, at least. We'll call them illusion. They're not permanent, and they have no real substance. So when we mistake what is, has no real reality to itself as real and grasp, which is our habit, that's when we get caught up with what we call materialism. And materialism can be of body, it can be of speech, and it can be of mind. So not only do we want to possess things that are like clothes, televisions or new gadgets or houses in this country. Everybody wants a beautiful house. You know, everybody wants to, we conflate happiness with having these things, having things. And of course, our contemporary culture is completely built around bombarding us with things that we might want. We're talked into believing that's what we really need. And so we're not going to be happy without them. And so then we get caught in this kind of endless cycle of wanting more, and when we get it, it doesn't work because we still want more. Wanting never ends. That's the thing about the desire realm. There's no end to wanting. And the more we feed it, the more we want. So it's kind of like that. So, you know, from the point of view of saying free of materialism, it's like keeping oneself more close to home and discovering what's really there. Is it all out there? Is that what really life is about? Is it really reality all out there? You know, given over totally to external circumstances because we're liked or because we're disliked or because we have things we want or, you know, we don't have things we want? I mean, where's the foundation of happiness? And so that's where the whole principle of wakefulness begins to come in. And we discover that we have something that we call basic goodness. And this basic goodness is not contingent on good or bad. We're still good even when we're bad because we still have this goodness. But of course, we can get it very clouded over, very obscured. So what we want to do is discover this goodness, this fundamental primordial simplicity. It is very simple. Everybody has this, and so it's also wakeful. And so if we can discover and start training in it, then we can discover how to free ourselves up from being entrapped by material impulses and thinking we have to have things to be happy. We can learn to be happy with what we are and have in the moment as it is. And that includes even being sick and destitute, if need be. It doesn't mean we throw ourselves away. We do need food, shelter, and clothing, of course. Absolutely. We're not into one of these ascetic things where we toss the world away and want to go out as an anchorite and live in the desert. That's not what really we're trying to do. We're trying to make use of what's available, best possible way. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Sorry if I went on too long.
Sounds like some similarities with Maslow.
To what?
Maslow and self-actualization.
Yeah, he picked up on Buddhism early on, I think. Yes?
I just got the book tonight. But I believe Pema Chodron says meditation is a process of unconditional friendliness with oneself.
Yes.
And I find when I'm meditating, though, and I get those thoughts, instead of trying to let them go, which I guess you're supposed to do, I find myself saying, oh, that's okay, you know, and then I find myself stuck in analyzing the thought of mm-hmm. what happened and trying to be friendly to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, I'm wondering if I'm being counterproductive. And is that one unconditional friendliness to oneself, is that all aspects of the self, or is she talking about that absolute bodhicitta part of the self, the one that's just the without all of those attachments?
Well, when we start talking like this, we're first of all talking about something called Maitri. And actually, this is touched on in the first three chapters as well. We're talking about the need to accommodate and make room for understanding who we are. And in order to do that, we have to be our friend. It's absolutely essential. Because you have a friend, it doesn't mean they want to stick their nose in your armpit, you know. But it means they understand, they can give you room to be who you are, and they appreciate you, and they understand you have foibles and peculiarities. I'm talking about real friends. We're not talking about fair weather friends or people who are just social acquaintances who, you know, are saying little niceties to each other and then forget about it the minute. I mean, somebody who could actually be there for you. We have to be here for ourselves. And in order to be here for ourselves, we have to be friends to ourselves, because otherwise we'll never be able to deal with what comes up. We'll never be able to see it. We will just completely suppress it like we've always been doing, because we feel, you know, it's not right, it's bad, I'm not good, or I don't want to waste my time with this, I've got more important things to do. But I mean, what it does is it gives us spaciousness to actually allow our thoughts to come up, all of our confused patterns, and we need to be able to do that in order to let them go. We actually need to see these things. Not only that, and this is kind of a secret kind of thing, you could say, we almost need this kind of confusion and craziness in order to wake up. I mean, why do we need badness in the world? I think partly because we need to learn what good is. If we only have good, we never know what it is. It's just like walking around in the dark, bumping into objects. We have no, I mean, maybe you say this is bad because I hit my head on that, but I mean, fundamentally, we don't know what it is. We define things by understanding, you know, by contrast. And we learn that, you know, confused mind is a very important part of our path. Not because we want to embrace it and hang around with it and cultivate it and feed it, but that we actually want to make use of this as an opportunity to wake up.
So are you saying that eventually, I don't know how long it takes, but eventually in meditation, you can get to a point where you can just see a thought and then just let it go and not have to kind of wrap your arms around it and take care of it?
We can do that right now. We don't have to coddle or take care of our thoughts. We let them go. That's the instruction. We do not want to analyze them, because that's getting into it. I mean, we can analyze later. We say, okay, I'm going to give myself, you know, later on after this meditation, in fact, so I'm going to sit down and analyze everything that I thought. But when we're doing the meditation, in order for us to really be able to do the meditation, we just let it go and don't treat it as anything. We can have a fantastic thought. I mean, wow, where did this come from? You know, I got to write this down in there. Really want to keep track of this. I want to do something with this. When I'm on the meditation cushion, I have to just say, back to breath, using the out breath to let it go. If it's really important, it will come back. It really will. And if it's not important, it won't. I mean, you have to trust yourself enough for that kind of thing. This was one problem that Trungpa Rinpoche, when he had the students, some of them were poets, and he said one of the problems with poets are that they can never go on a retreat because they always have their notebook. Anything comes in, I got to write it down. You know, you never know when I'm going to make use of that word or combination. So we're actually learning how to really open ourselves up to something else. That's kind of it's completely unknown on some level because it's unknown. It's not something you can grasp, and this is an important point. When I said earlier that, you know, our Buddha mind is beyond grasping, is because the mind cannot grasp it. The mind can not grasp its own nature. If we ask, who am I? We don't get an answer. You don't go, well, I'm this, that, and the other thing, and I'm going to start making lists now. You're just staring a blank. Why am I? Yeah. Whither? So, instead of going, ugh, moving on, we want to sort of like stay there for a while. Learn what that means. And it means that we let go of all this other stuff. And we actually begin to sort of acquire a familiarity with something else. This is more central, kind of core. Yes, Jen?
I'm wondering if, like when you say being a friend to your thoughts, it's like, you know, like there's a gentleness about letting it go and a lightness and maybe even a little bit of a sense of humor about it all.
You just put that's the recipe. That, I mean, it's not that I have to oppose those conditions on my thoughts in order to be gentle. It's more like you do a light touch. And so one of the things we didn't talk about in the meditation instruction, which is a good idea now, is this notion of light touch. Touch and go. You know, I'm here. I'm sitting. The thought comes up. I'm letting it go. I just let it go. Just keep on letting it go. And I know that this is hard to do because our minds are constantly seduced by thinking and being caught up and, you know, carrying around and experiencing this and that and wanting to go here or there. So that's why we want to start with very shorter periods of time to be able to just dedicate that to this purpose. And then there will be time, if we need time later, to deal with it. But, I mean, right now we're learning how to actually leave ourselves alone so we can actually be. Just, what does it mean to just be? And so it's so simple and so hard at the same time. So as the question is, what happens later? I don't know what happens later. I've been doing this for quite a long time myself. I keep getting screwy thoughts. It isn't like they suddenly go away, you know. But one person put it, Dingo Kensei Rinpoche was a very famous yogi who was a teacher, one of the teachers of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And he gave a teaching and saying, basically, it's more like an older person watching children play in a playground. You're sitting there watching, you know, I can't go out there. I've already had my kids. It's not my first one. I'm going to have to go out and make sure, mop up everything from the get-go. But just letting them play themselves out, letting them play. They're going to go through their arguments. They got to cry. It's the end of the world. Okay, fine. You know, you're just letting it go, right? Or watching animals play, you know, dogs, you know, running circles around each other. Okay, fine. You know, you're just sitting there bystanding and paying, you're sort of observing it without engaging with it. So that's kind of how it goes, because you begin to realize that this nature we're talking about as it goes on is a tremendous source of intelligence. It is the source of intelligence and wisdom and understanding, and so that it doesn't need to worry about fiddling. This was one thing I was going to bring up. You don't fiddle with your thoughts. No toolbox. No fixing and adjusting, and, you know, I want it to really feel like this. I don't like that thought. Let's put it over here, you know. We're just going to drop it, and continue dropping it. Make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we could look a little bit at this. Um, So I've said something about wakefulness as intrinsic, the original basis, kind of primordial. That's basically the intro. And then he's saying, discussing wakefulness and sleep, and what does that mean? Contemplate, what does sleep mean? What does sleepiness mean? What does sleepwalking mean? Well, what we're going to discover in our practice is that we're sleepwalking most of the time. And how we're sleepwalking, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that instead of actually really being present and relating to something as it emerging and being there, we're falling back on these systems or tapes or recorded responses or patterns of response and interactions that we always rely on because they've worked before or we think they worked before. After all, isn't that what you say when someone says this to you, blah, blah, blah? Or maybe I'm supposed to be a person who does this. All these various presuppositions we have, these are all basically acting out patterns. Now, many of us probably never really investigated where these patterns came from. But if you try to find them, you're never going to find out where they came from. They came from nowhere. The way it's actually described, one more categorization. This is the seventh. We did mention these, I think, in one of the earlier teachings with Pema Chodron, the nidanas. Nidanas, which are basically the way we become. And the first nidana is basically ignorance, and then the second nidana is pattern. So what happens is out of this swarming kind of state of confusion in our unconscious space, we discover there are these patterns that recur. And then the next thing they show up as some kind of, oh, I'm here, consciousness. This consciousness is all about me being here, me being somebody, without ever knowing who I am. But I'm saying it anyway. I'm declaring it me. Okay? So it goes on. It's got stages of 12 all the way up to old age, sickness, and death, basically. But it's fundamentally characterizes how our patterns emerge and how they articulate themselves. So those are that's kind of like the sleepwalking. I'm walking around doing what I always do because I've always done it, or I'm supposed to do it. We're not really relating to now. We're not really taking it fresh. We're not being here in the moment. So the path of meditation is to uncover all of this. And so often when we have, one of the things Trungpa Rinpoche said was, it's not so much that we are trying to become enlightened as much as we are trying or learning how to unmask deception, self-deception. We're unmasking. So it's an unmasking process. It's a peeling off. This is why it's work. This is good work. And the Buddhist path, when you do this, is called the noble path. You actually are engaging on a noble path. It's a path because it's noble because you're actually willing to establish yourself in the truth. Truth about yourself, truth about the world, truth about what is. I mean, who could think of a higher definition of nobility than living completely the truth? But it's radical. This is like very different from conventional notions of nobility and stature and elevation and exaltation. So this is the kind of exaltation that is actually completely 100% unconstructed, unfabricated, and natural. So he expressed it in terms of learning how to meditate, uncover, and then finally, just briefly outlining, gathering with others to express compassion or express the wisdom itself. And so compassion is where we got to with Pema when she's talking about compassion as responsiveness, natural responsiveness to what is arising in our lives. It's not only great notions about saving the world and help and being a nurse and caring and coddling others, but it's actually about basic, genuine responsiveness And that forms the basis for interaction with anything or anybody. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. We're starting with something more fundamental. We can get articulate all these other nice expressions that occur, care, compassion, and we talked earlier about the four limitless ones, which I know was repeated several times in the class of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. We discussed those as being elements of what we would generally call compassion. But we have to start with something more, even more essential than that, which is basically natural, genuine responsiveness. And so by doing that, we discover that, this is basically how we connect with the basic wisdom mind in ourselves, and how this wisdom mind in ourselves is the basis for connecting genuinely with all others. So, let's see. Pages here. Okay. Any questions about that first situation? Then chapter one is the reruns, which we kind of touched on earlier. That's on page one. Awakening to the life of reruns. So that's the habitual patterns. And so we're discovering, as I'll just quote here, meditation is the natural path of spiritual awakening. So we haven't used the word spiritual up until now, but for the sake of everybody's desire, particularly if we have any religious or spiritual impulses, here it is. It is a spiritual path. It is spiritual, but without any kind of makeup or jewelry or clap, other things that like weigh things down with, solemnity and. I'm not saying all religions are like this, but many, you can get this way, as you know. You can do it with Buddhism, too, by the way. Don't worry. So, the Buddha discovered a middle way of developing our innate human potential, an approach to meditating that avoids the twin traps of trying to force the mind to be still or letting it run wild. And so that's right into the business of meditation itself. So this Buddha nature is fundamentally innate, and it exists for the most part as, even though it's a reality, it's still a potential. We need to develop it. We need to actually exercise awareness as a natural capacity we have for waking up. Okay? And so, avoiding the twin traps of trying to force the mind to be still because it won't do any good, or on the other hand, letting it run wild is likewise going to make us miserable. We did suggest, however, maybe a month ago or something, I discussed, we walked through some other methods of meditation besides one we recommend, which is using your out-breath, where you can count your breaths as a means to simply steady the mind. It's a temporary function, and it's useful. You could spend 5 minutes or so counting your breath, just counting in, out, 1, 2, 3, 4. Just let it go, counting, and it will settle the mind. So that actually, if you're finding yourself really out there and, overwhelmed, then just start counting your breath. And then as we continue to get more, let's say, used to what it means to do our meditation practice, we can actually trust more of the use of simple breath, that our breathing is going to go on regardless. And so we want to make sure we're breathing, and sometimes we stop breathing when we really get caught up. So just even paying attention to that, we're paying attention. We're just coming back to the moment as it is, paying attention. And that is enough. Paying attention, just watching, just observing, without going anywhere with the observation. We're not trying to take it into anything, turn it into anything. We're just basically seeing. and letting that go with the seeing. Don't hang on to the seeing. We have an insight, fine, let it go. You know, just drop it, disown it. This was a famous word Trungpa Rinpoche used, disown your moment ago when you were absolutely certain you hit that, hit the $64 button, you know, like, wow, I mean, I got it. Back to breath. Drop it. So, seeing this is already enough. I think that's basically the whole issue. And then he says, he's talking about how seeing bad news as good news. That was on page 8. Did anybody see that? Talking about how the bad news is that we're completely soaked in our patterns, totally absorbed and owned by elements that are other, our own projections, which we don't even own ourselves, even though we call them that. They're not really ourselves. And when we begin to start seeing this, it's like, ay, 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 you know, what I mean, whoa, do I really want to do this? But, you know, then that's the thing. The good news is, yes, is we're seeing it. Because if we see it, then we can drop it. We can loosen it, loosen the grip. You know, we have this constant chattering mind, like a chain link fence, one thought linking up to the next ad infinitum, constantly going up and down. And, you know, we can just basically go, ah. And, you know, you poke a little hole in this little thick, you know, kind of like ongoing stream, and you start poking a hole in it just by noticing and letting it go, poking a hole, poking a hole. It starts to loosen up. It's like Fearless Foster. Do you remember that cartoon character who had get shot by arrows, bullets, and he'd have holes in him, you know? I mean, finally where there's nothing left, just his hat's left or something, you know? You just basically, it weakens the grip of, and this is why it's gentle, because it's not like anything's being forced. Nobody's forcing a thing. So in the process of seeing and relaxing with that and letting it go, that's all we have to do. And then it's going to come back again. Believe me, it's not going to stop because you saw it once, by any means. But we keep looking, dropping it. Keep looking, dropping it. And it gets weaker and weaker progressively. And we discover, actually, that we start to discover some freedom. Now, that's the one thing that, you know, might intimidate some people, because they don't know if they really want that much freedom. I mean, how can they handle that freedom? I mean, this is, it is a, you know, it is, it's a little demanding. Freedom. But, you know, I mean, that's basically what the possibilities are, that innately we have this freedom and we have to recapture it through our practice. Does this make sense? Any questions or any concerns or observations, I'd be happy, please, share it with us all, because we're all learning from each other. Yes, Robert.
Sometimes I feel like I'm almost splitting myself in two, and I wondered if other people feel that way, because to observe myself thinking, it's like when I'm talking, I can't stop sometimes. I would like to stop, but I'm thinking, oh, I can't believe I'm saying all this. Part of me is, you know, observing myself, babbling, getting a motor mouth. But I don't know if meditation is supposed to be that way, where you have the part of yourself. It's really hard for me to let go of the thoughts, but I can sort of separate a part of my mind and look at myself.
Anybody like to comment?
Like, or watching the children play. There's
lots of children. Misbehaving.
Yeah, unruly as all hell. Yes.
Well, I find that when I'm working, I can't lapse. I cannot go to slowing down and being watchful of what I'm saying and doing. Much easier when I'm totally relaxed. It's certainly easier in meditation. But if I'm at work and I have to have something that, you know, I'm teaching, I gotta keep talking. And I'm trying to think of, am I making sense to these kids, and how am I, you know, I'm not really putting that any kind of, you know, Buddha practice or whatever into that. It's all about getting them what I mean, the purpose that I'm there for. But, and then sometimes, and I realize in my conversations with colleagues, oh, that's where I start to screw up, you know, or sometimes I'm actually more conscious with kids than I am sometimes with colleagues. And then I realize, but then how do you slow down? It's almost like you have to talk so slowly that it will make people crazy, you know? That's how I, you know, right? If you were to slow down.
Yes, I'd be going,
right, and then you know, it would be, right, yeah.
People, wouldn't people be hedging on your every word? Like, to hear what you have to say next? Because you're talking so slowly.
Well, I think you could incorporate some of that, but we start with our meditation just as an isolated factor, where we're actually just going to do it. You know, I'm planning myself, I'm going to sit, and I'm going to just be here and only just do everything to let go. See and let go. See, release, breathe, just be here, open myself up. As time goes on, we can gain more confidence in this process, and we can begin to do it. Now, you could conceive, I mean, it's not inconceivable that right now you could take one nanosecond in your work time just to flash on that. You know, but if you have some basis to build on, which is to say your meditation experience at home or wherever you do it, then you have something, you're not trying to go back to that. You're just flashing on the present. You just have that experience that you can begin to draw on in terms of an acknowledgement. Okay, I'm here, you know. Just stop, you know. I'm just stopping for a moment. And, you know, go back, then relax, and then attend to what you're doing. And, you know, you'll find that by doing that, you're inviting more of the awareness possibility into the moment of your work. So we're not supposed to stop working because we want to meditate, but we want to be able to bring our meditation to enrich our work and realize awareness doesn't have any argument at all with what's happening. That's the key point. So if your mind is raging, you're just going to start trusting and learning more about resting in the awareness of it. And then you're going to take it's going to light the air out of the tires on some level. Yeah.
Perhaps or not, this is related, I'm not sure, that in terms of the deeper kind of listening that this work is asking of us, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, the job or in the real world or wherever, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's the same, and perhaps you just said this, but I'm wondering if it's the same thing as really leaning into what it is you're doing right now with your students. So that I'm a teacher too, so that I am relearning this at the same time that my students are. Mm-hmm. And so that it's not about me, it's about the it that we're doing together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually run into more trouble with colleagues, then it gets to be more about me. And with the students, it's easy to be, it's all about you guys, you know. But
yeah, you're giving yourself over. You're giving yourself over.
And then I have to send an email to kind of explain my actions or something to a colleague, because I realize, oh, what did I do? That wasn't very... nice, or it wasn't very respectful, or it wasn't
mm-hmm.
very compassionate. I don't know.
So you do that too. In other words, we're living, if you start to engage on this as a path of awareness, then you're going to have to go through all the bumps in the road that are there. And so if I do something uncouth, which I've been known to do, or, you know, stumble or fall, well, I did that, you know. I mean, okay, I own up to it, move on. I'm not going to stand there and beat my breast for, you know, 2 days about it. I mean, it's like we're just going to move forward with what's happening now. But we can also acknowledge that I said something out of turn or was inappropriate or maybe I didn't really listen properly. All those things are part of what awareness involves. It's not awareness of some special thing only that can only occur when I'm sitting in this cushion. It actually is employed all the time. We just don't recognize it. That's the first big thing, is that we begin to recognize how more and more it's already here. We're not going to go somewhere else. You know, we're not moving into some other dimension that's not in here. We're actually right here. We're just going to learn how to be what it means to be here with all the things that come up. And we're going to learn how to trust ourselves in that. That's the key point. So that meditation is a learning about me enough so that I don't have to be ruled by my unruly parts and all about the parts that are completely fixated on goals and only driven by, you know, taking care of, satisfying my urges or any of these things. I mean, we come back to very kind of practical ways of how to be decent, you know. Being decent means being sensitive because you're really aware of the impact you have on others, the whole question of what your words are, how your body movements affect other people's, all of the things we do in terms of interacting is all about engaging. And as we learn how to engage with more awareness, we're sort of tanking up, as it were, on a meditation cushion, because we're actually learning how to actually open up more and more and discover what that actually is by what it is not. And what it is not is all this stuff that comes up in our minds. We're just simply letting it go. We don't know what it, we're not going to say, I don't know, we're not going to break it apart and try to take it down to its, that's a whole different thing. That's not meditation. That is, at best, a form of contemplation. Now, contemplation is important, particularly when we study teachings and understand how we can apply them. We want to understand them. But analysis has its place, but it also has its limitations. Mm-hmm. And when we're meditating, we are not analyzing. That's a key point.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Mm-hmm. Is the awareness that we're talking about, is it like observing without judgment? So we're observing our... I'm observing the burn in my back when I was sitting there, and mm-hmm. in that way, I'm not judging it, because and then as soon as I started judging it, it's like, oh, jeez. But to sit and observe it and not judge and just be, like, observe the burning. It's like, yep, that's burning, all right. That's really burning, and then for a few seconds, I'm away from the burning, and it kept coming back, but it was. I had just even a couple seconds of, oh, it's not burning anymore. No, you know, and that's what I observed because I tried to, as I observed, the judgment sort of lifted. Not completely, but it just, you know, little seconds or moments of that lifting. Mm-hmm. And so is that what we're talking about, awareness? Being in the moment?
There's a couple of things involved here. One is, of course, there's nothing wrong with, if your legs are killing you, just acknowledge it and make your adjustments. We're not trying to torture ourselves. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things is that there's a natural thing when we sit is that we often find our lower back muscles are not strong and need strengthening through the practice itself. And so there is going to have to be some endurance about that, strengthening your lower back so that you can actually sit more easily in an erect posture. That's very important. At the same time, there is this other thing you're bringing up, which is about simply, yes, you know, sensation, you know, unpleasant, dropping it, using your breath to let go. And you know, there are some points where we cannot avoid pain, certain specific pains, certain kind of illnesses. We can learn how to use our breath to actually work with that as well, to make it more manageable at least. Right? Well, we're not just simply trying to reach for something to knock ourselves out so we don't feel anything. We're totally numbing ourselves. And that has its consequence on our brain and cognitive faculties. But, you know, basically, I think the important thing is to, in this case, allow yourself to feel some pain and then also use enough intelligence to respond to that. Maybe I need to sit in a different way that I'm not going to be putting myself through so much torture. But do give myself a chance to strengthen my lower back so that I can, you know, learn how to actually sit up. Posture is very important in this whole process, I have to say.
I have another thing that I always witness when I first start sitting. And if I just keep on breathing through it and trying to love it up, you know, it actually does subside. And I think that's what I heard you saying, that there was, you know, this inner witnessing that was happening. And that seems to be, at least from my experience, I'm not, you know, a long time meditator like other people perhaps in this room, but it definitely seems like there is a process of letting go. Like once you hit the pillow, it's like there's a deepening that could occur.
So your expression, loving it up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not passionately loving it up. It's
more about
gentleness.
Yeah.
Introducing the notion of gentleness. So the gentleness here is about treating things lightly instead of like heavy-handedly, right? That's the key point about this light touch quality. We're learning how to be gentle to ourselves and merciful. This is another key point. Merciful to others so that, you know, we can understand and give them room to be confused, just like we ourselves are confused. We're not going to jump in and, you know, lay a judgment on them. Okay. We're not getting too far in this book yet. Sorry. But I feel like we're making some really important progress in terms of talking about our meditation, and this is one of the reasons we are really here, is to actually truly understand how can we meditate well, and what do we need to understand in order to do that. So it involves at least two things. One is certainly reading material and learning about what people have to say who are skilled meditators and helping us learn how to work with, you know, sometimes very unsettling experiences, and sharing this with each other so that we're all on this learning curve together, and we're all learning from each other as well. We're not just sitting here, pupils passively listening to, you know, somebody else. We want to learn from each other. Yeah, so again, the here is like one of the things, at least in terms of the discursive thoughts, which occur constantly, our chattering minds, is on page 9 he mentions about inquiring in a curious and friendly way, what are we thinking? And then I wanted to add something in the context of this. If you want to know what you're thinking, look at the texture. Look at the color. You can ask, is there a color to this thought? Is there a shape to this thought? How does it feel? You know, what does a thought feel like? Can we actually experience that? And, you know, we look at this, and when we do this, this is not analyzing. It's just basically investigating with very straightforwardly and simply. It lightens the whole thing up. It's another means to lighten up. Okay? We can look at that, feel it, and let it go. We feel it. We're not sort of pretending that that didn't feel good. But instead of like oh well, you know, like thinking, it's about, you know, just letting it go. What is it? Opening it to it and dropping it. Opening to it. So opening to it means we really see it. We really feel it. That was a difficult thought. I'm not labeling it. Other than that, I'm just calling it a thought. But you know, I'm dropping it. And so when it comes back, it's not going to come back with the same kind of intensity. And that's the other thing we begin to learn about, is much more lightness. So we treat the thoughts lightly. They can, in turn, come back a little less heavily. But, of course, you never know. Wow! Something comes out and really takes over. So Maitri, we talked about, this is the most important thing. It's all about being friendly. We're beyond rejection. We're opening ourselves up to the unfamiliar. And we're learning how to accept awkwardness. Okay? And so then, you know, it's sort of like, it sort of helps it learn itself. I mean, if we're awkward, we learn, when we first take our first steps, they're always going to be awkward. You've never seen kids who just immediately know exactly how to walk. They need lots of testing. And so we're awkward, we're working with that. And as time goes on, it settles. So, it's a way, so I think that that's probably enough for tonight. I mean, in terms of just, we've covered the first chapter, the elements of the first chapter. Are there any questions that anybody else saw in that chapter they wanted to bring up? Okay. All right. So next week, I think we should continue with this. Chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5. You'll have read the first couple of chapters, so that should go easy. Do give, we'll put an announcement out on the, we'll probably make an email announcement, and it'll also be on the website, the reading for next week. That way, you know, if you have any questions, you can call. Michael and Emily are out of town. They should be back Monday, and you could either contact them or me to, you know, discuss any of these matters if you wanted to, or not clear about the reading assignment or any of that. So, all right. So now, again, for those of you who are here for the first time, we have been accumulating merit by doing our practice and study. And so, in Buddhism, when we accumulate merit, we give it away. And that's what we do, we dedicate to merit. So we're going to do this recitation, which is the dedication of merit. And, you've got one, okay. Okay. By this merit, may all attain perfect awakening, rising of all forces of negativity, coming out of the ruins of birth, old age, sickness, and death, may all be free from the ocean of samsara. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.